In her book, When Things Fall Apart, the North American Buddhist nun Pema Chodron says this: "Things falling apart is a kind of testing and also a kind of healing. We think that the point is to pass the test or to overcome the problem, but the truth is that things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart. Then they come together and they fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen. Room for grief, for relief, for misery, for joy. When we think that something is going to bring us pleasure, we don't know what's really going to happen. When we think something is going to give us misery, we don't know. Letting there be room for not knowing is the most important thing at all. We try to do what we think is going to help, but we don't know. We never know if we're going to fall flat or sit up tall. When there's a big disappointment, we don't know if that's the end of the story. It may be just the beginning of a great adventure."
When my mother was 18, she married a man who was so abusive, he pushed her down a flight of stairs when she was pregnant with me. To her credit, she left him after that, moved home, had me, and when I was 2, met and married the man who I knew as my one and only dad. This would have stayed a family secret, but when I was 13, an aunt who was angry with my dad decided to get back at him by telling me that he was not my biological father and made sure that he knew that I knew it. Although I knew my parents loved me and were just trying to protect me, my world was turned upside down. At 13, I was just trying to figure out who I was, and now my life story was a lie. This loss of what I thought was true, this disillusionment, made me wary and distrustful of those closest to me. When I was in my mid-20s, I read a book by Father Bruce Ritter, who founded Covenant House in New York City. Covenant House was founded in 1972 to rescue street kids. This book was so inspiring to me that I was called to find ways to help to make the world better, that part of my purpose in life was to find ways to advocate for the forgotten and overlooked in this money means everything society. A few years later, in 1990, Father Bruce Ritter was forced to resign from Covenant House after widespread reports that he had committed sexual abuse against several of the young boys in his charity. When I heard the news, I was shocked and sickened. I questioned ability to choose heroes wisely. I'm sure that you've dealt with the same disillusionment when the admired and respected politician, actor, activist, journalist, coach, fill in the blank, turns out to have been someone who has done something to hurt others. Now, as a parent of adult children, I have learned that love cannot fix everything. Love cannot cure addiction. I believe that if I raise my daughters in a loving home that allowed them the freedom to be themselves, they would be okay. Even knowing that addiction is a disease, I thought 2 loving parents, family dinners, being raised in a UU congregation would ensure that even if they needed rehab, it would work and it would be okay. When this did not happen, I felt lost, guilty, and disillusioned. I had done everything I thought was right in my most important job as a mom, and I failed. Disillusionment, reality checks, hard truths are all part of life. And as painful as they have been, learning to deal with them has been part of my spiritual practice. To unravel how I felt about my dad and my identity took finding a great therapist. And being open to understanding my parents, myself, and the harm in keeping secrets. My therapist helped me to see how I can love my parents and be disappointed in them at the same time. After finding out that Bruce Ritter committed horrible crimes, I could have become jaded and distrustful of do-gooders. But I decided to believe that for every Bruce Ritter, there are thousands of individuals who make a difference in someone's life. I would like to think I'm one of these people, and I know many of you here in this room are doing wonderful things to help the world. Dealing with my daughter's addiction has shown me the benefits of reaching out for help. It has taught me to accept the things I cannot change. And by being open and vulnerable, I have been helped, and am helping others. As I grow older, and hopefully a little wiser, I'm learning to be more gentle with myself and others. We are all just so human, and often it is my unrealistic expectations that create my disillusionment. I can feel hurt, shocked, angry, or hopeless, but how I react is up to me. I can stay angry, hurt, and become bitter, or I can move towards love, empathy, understanding, and compassion. I choose love.
Our Sunday service theme this winter is sources of meaning and inspiration. It's worth noting that sometimes the hopes or beliefs which have given us meaning or inspiration turn out to be flawed, unfounded, or false. Whether as parents, children, partners, or as idealists of any kind, when disillusionment happens, it's painful. So let's examine disillusionment, starting with the word itself. To be disillusioned means to have an illusion exposed, removed, taken away, knocked off its pedestal. To be disillusioned is to lose something that wasn't really reliable, not real in the first place. According to a spiritual teacher of mine, to be disillusioned is to experience a loss. And she said, we will experience losses like this over and over in our lives. It could be simple, such as, I used to believe that X was real or true, but now I no longer do. Or it could be heartbreaking, like, I thought if I was a really good child, a really good person, nothing bad would happen to me. Learning such lessons is like a seed cracking its shell, she said, and it's painful. She told me that when we are disillusioned, our spiritual work is the work of grieving. Disillusionment is a kind of death, and sometimes it can have additional complications. Along with feeling angry or sad at the loss, we can feel foolish or ashamed for believing something that turns out not to be true. Also, she said, we often hold such beliefs unconsciously until they are exposed by something that contradicts them. We see those beliefs clearly for the first time, just as they are being taken away from us. Ouch. This has resonance for my own life. When I was a little boy and a teenager, I didn't realize how much I looked up to a couple of adult relatives. Their support of me was important. As a lonely kid, I treasured their attention and encouragement. When we were together, I craved their delight in my accomplishments. But I didn't realize that I was putting those adult relatives on a pedestal, maybe two pedestals. As I grew into adulthood, I began expressing my full self, becoming someone different from their expectations. They didn't like it. I came to see how narrow their support really had been, and how narrow-minded. As a boy, I had valued their acceptance and had thought it was unconditional. Now I saw their support had conditions. One of them tried to constrain my emerging adult identity, perhaps acting out of fear or ignorance, which they thought was love and concern, but it hurt. Consequently, one of them came crashing down off the pedestal. The other one fell off some years later. To me, each time it felt like a betrayal, a loss, and a confusing one at that. Looking back, I can imagine that when I was growing up, they had put me on a pedestal too. This means that all their attempts to control me were frantic efforts on their part to keep me on that pedestal. So they had illusions too. They had a loss too. Things fell apart for all of us. The Buddhist nun Pema Chodron says, "Things falling apart is a kind of testing and also a kind of healing. The healing comes from letting there be room in us, room for grief, for relief, for misery, for joy. To make space for joy and relief, we also need to make space for honesty and frustration." Let's consider some examples from politics. I have been deeply disappointed in some elected officials. Disillusioned, you could say. Not by the ones I didn't like, but by those I did, those who had inspired me, those in whom I put my hopes and expectations. Sometimes in my grief at such losses, I withdrew from caring, withdrew from giving so much of myself to the political process. Then I realized that it's inevitable to be disappointed. The political system of democracy is not perfect, and the political system includes imperfect and flawed human beings, just as any other system does. Indeed, this is the reason we have democracy, because nobody is perfect, and no single person should be expected to meet all our needs or solve all our problems as a nation. I remember when my father and a few other family members were disillusioned in the 1970s when President Richard Nixon's dishonesty and corruption were exposed. These family members accepted that he had to resign from office, but it was hard for them. It hurt to be let down by the leader they'd voted for. It shook their faith in their political system. Other family members, however, didn't have this experience of disillusionment. They were not surprised at Nixon's fall. They were relieved. Their faith in representative government wasn't shaken up when he resigned. It was renewed and restored. It's important to point out that many Americans haven't had an experience of having idealistic beliefs about their government exposed as illusions. They never had the luxury of illusions to lose. They never had the privilege. In particular, this is true for many folks in traditionally marginalized groups in this country, including people of color. As I am learning, if you have regular experiences of your vulnerability in a society, it's hard to submit to an illusion that it's a great one, or a safe one, or a fair one. It's harder to be let down, hard to be surprised. Angry or scared, perhaps, but not surprised. Another example, the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement has unveiled the long-standing epidemic of sexual assault and harassment in this country, to the surprise of many people. Yet for those who went through such traumas, there is no illusion of safety to lose by these revelations. Perhaps there has been disillusionment on the part of those who felt they could get away with abuse. They lost the illusion that getting away with something meant it was okay for them. When I think about the privilege of having illusions, I think about myself in my first career, which was in state government back in the Midwest. Since junior high school, I'd been thinking about public policy and loving it. I read the newspaper's editorial pages, argued with people about government and politics, and felt like an involved citizen, even though I couldn't vote yet. After finishing grad school at age 24, I got a job in the governor's budget office in the state of Illinois. Among other tasks there, I analyzed public assistance programs for poor people. A few years later, I got a job working in a State Department of Human Services, where I managed grant contracts to fund not-for-profit providers in communities around the state. For an idealistic young adult, these were dream jobs. I felt so engaged in trying to make things better. Over time, however, I encountered selfish people, vindictive behaviors, and unethical situations that shocked and upset me. In the state government and in the community agencies and in their trade associations, I was appalled by examples of human greed, self-centeredness, arrogance, dishonesty, and pettiness. How could this happen with people in positions dedicated to serving the public? How could this happen? Some of the people and the behaviors I encountered not only disappointed me, they upset my idealism. They not only shook my faith in the goodness of community service, they shook my faith in humanity. This hurt, and I was hurting. At this time of testing, where could I find the space to grieve my lost faith? I knew I wasn't going to find compassion among the people who'd let me down. I didn't trust them anymore. Fortunately, I was active in the UU congregation in that city. I had joined it after moving to town. By attending services and by working with other volunteers there, I got to know adults who were 20, 40, 60 years older than I was. Many of these UUs had worked in the same systems that I was appalled by. How could they stand it? How did they survive? After all, as Unitarian Universalists, we talked in church about our values, about human worth and dignity, about fairness, democracy, and honesty. How could they stand to have those values trampled in their work lives? At our minister's urging, I reached out to a few of these experienced UU civil servants. I described my unreal experiences, my dilemmas, my disappointments, and they listened. They took me seriously. They affirmed my disappointment. Of course, what I was confronting for the first time, they had seen for years. They had navigated their way through the hard stuff of their jobs in order to do what they could in service of the greater good. Sometimes they had resisted the way things were, both in risky ways and in quieter ones. I came to see that they resisted what they didn't like in their work life by the ways they voted, the places they chose to give their money to, and by supporting their congregation, which kept their values alive and visible for them. As I told them about my disappointment and my dilemmas, nobody told me what I should do. They accepted my experience as valid. They affirmed my values as worthy ones. As I wrestled through disillusionment, they gave me space to grieve. They didn't give me easy answers. They didn't act as if they knew the answers. They just showed me kindness. Pema Chodron says, letting there be room for not knowing is the most important thing of all. When there's a big disappointment, we don't know if that's the end of the story. It may be just the beginning of a great adventure. That first career lasted a decade. As I look back, I realize that I was destined for disillusionment wherever I was. I was so naive. No matter where I started out as an idealistic young adult in my first career, it was inevitable that my faith would be shaken and my ideals disappointed. Wherever I was planted, I would come face to face with human sinfulness or if you prefer a bureaucratic phrasing, with humanity's weak performance record. This turned out to be a suitable preparation for going to theological seminary. In seminary, we discussed human goodness and evil. We read what philosophers and theologians had to say about human aspirations and human folly. We wrestled with ideas of divine intentions and our human free will. In these readings and conversations, I was able to think of real examples from my own life experience. That was helpful. It made religious questions relevant. So I knew about the pain of disillusionment, and I saw it as part of our human condition. But to this, I now add new lessons that I've learned. These have to do with compassion, the importance of our presence and our kindness. It can be a source of healing to give space for grieving, to allow for the honest expression of loss. This includes the loss of something that wasn't really there in the first place, or at least wasn't as reliable as we wanted it to be. It can be healing to acknowledge this as both genuine and painful. In the presence of the disillusionment of another person, we can show the kindness of allowing space without excuses, easy answers, or quick solutions. And if it's our own disappointment, our own pain, we can treat ourselves with compassion too. Part of doing this might be to reach out to those who have shown themselves to be trusted sources of presence and kindness. We can receive compassion, we can offer it. In thinking about this service, I looked up synonyms and antonyms for the word disillusionment. The synonyms, the similar words, include things like letdown, discouragement, setback, as you might expect. But what struck me were the antonyms. These words are not exact opposites of disillusionment. Instead, they reflect the aim toward healing from it. The opposites listed for disillusionment are words like peace, calmness, confidence. The opposites of disillusionment are gifts like assurance and encouragement, gifts like beauty and pleasure and ease. And to this we can add kindness and room for not knowing the answers. Pema Chodron says, letting there be room for not knowing is the most important thing of all. She writes that healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen, room for grief, for relief, for misery, for joy. As we go through our days, perhaps this can be our practice. To pause and breathe, to breathe and be open, so that we might be more able to make room for grief and relief, make room for misery and for joy. Not all that we thought was true always turns out to be reliable, and that is a loss, often a painful one. As we go through our days, losses of all kinds may be inevitable. Yet we can choose to be reliable. By our kind presence with ourselves, we invite healing. By our kind presence with others, we share compassion. So may we strive to live now and in the days to come. Blessed be. Amen.